So good evening, everyone. In our tradition, you know, you all may be coming to practice, probably do come to practice for a range of intentions, aspirations, a range of goals. We may not all share the same purposes in our practice, but in the tradition, the aim of the practice is what's called liberation through non-clinging. And I think many of you are familiar with that phrase, some of you may not be. And that's a big topic of what are the implications of that? What does it really mean? And to really unpack the ramifications and the implications of what we really mean by a profound liberation through non-clinging. And I'm going to leave that just undefined. I just bring that up because we are talking a lot here about cultivating wholesome qualities of mindfulness. We say insight, concentration, these states of the heart and the mind. All of those qualities are important, and as you, I'm sure, everyone knows, are valuable and important in their own right for their own benefits, and we can see that for ourselves. In service of liberation through non-clinging, then we can see that none of those qualities are ultimately the goal in and of themselves, but they're in the service of this liberation. And so holding them in that way, we can see that since we've been saying this since the beginning of the retreat, since we're all different, what's needed, what's most useful for each of us varies, then these qualities can be cultivated, they can develop on their own in different combinations, and then we can choose to cultivate them in with different emphasis. And we've been talking about that a lot on the retreat. Tonight, I'm going to focus the emphasis on the discussion on one of these qualities, which is the word that we use this term, concentration. And I'll define it a little more clearly in just a few moments. The word that we, in Pali and in Sanskrit, is samadhi. We typically translate as concentration. And what I want to do tonight is a few things. I'd like to discuss some of the range of ways in which samadhi is understood, practiced, experienced, taught. I want to start with looking kind of the traditional ways they're taught, and I don't want to get too much into texts, but I'm going to go a little bit into just the kind of the classic ways they're taught, the traditional ways, and then I want to open it up more practically, and I want to really spend most of the time practically talking about a range of ways that actually put into practice and implemented and experienced. And a big piece of that is, how is it practiced, experienced, and taught in relationship to insight? And that's a huge topic, so we're just going to kind of open the main ideas of that this evening. You know, this storm is actually I think it's quite apropos on the topic of samadhi, because the storm is raging and we are still. And this gets into something we'll talk about, because there's different kinds of stillness. There's one kind of calm, if you will, or serenity or stillness when there's no storms. But we also, even when we get underneath that, our stillness is not dependent on, so the storm clouds of the mind can even be coming through, and there can be a place more foundationally that is just allowing all this unfolding and manifestation and rising and passing away, and it's not dependent on the actual contents of our experience being still. That's a different kind. That's a real equanimity. So we may say more about that. So I will talk some about, I actually want to say a few, my own take on different ways you can understand what we mean by insight. And that's a big topic, which are a range of ways. And then also practically how different ways people think of that, them coming together. It can be confusing. It may not be for some of you, but because different teachers naturally, understandably, have their own perspective and emphasis on this, because people tend to teach from what they were taught, what they were practiced, and what really worked well for them. And so it's quite natural understanding that would be quite a range of what we call skillful means or teachings and approaches, because there's so many different things that have worked for so many different teachers. So I hope by the time we finish tonight, we won't be confused, but we just really can kind of relax and see that it's quite a big landscape, and then we can listen to our hearts to find what works best for each of us. So I want to begin with a quote. This is from Jack Kornfield, from an interview with him on the topic of samadhi, because I think this sets the right tone, I hope will hold. I was interviewing him, and I asked him this question. I asked him what his thoughts were about, you know, why there's such a range of views about samadhi. Again, I'm using this term. I haven't really defined it yet, but we'll get there. And he talked about I think it was his first book back in the early 1970s, which was published under the name of Living Buddhist Masters. It's still in print as Living Dharma. And he said, the book has 12 different, we use the term masters, Thai and Burmese. Each of these teachers had different approaches to Vipassana practice, and some of them emphasized concentration more than others. In many cases, they did not agree with one another on the best way to practice. Sometimes the styles were diametrically opposed to one another. In laying out Living Buddhist Masters, I deliberately contrasted the teachings so that one great master who emphasized meditation on the body as the best way to attain enlightenment was next to another enlightened master who said the only way to get liberated is to meditate on the mind. I did this so people would understand that there are a number of different skillful means to cultivate the factors of enlightenment and come to liberation. Any practices that cultivate mindfulness and wise effort and investigation and joy and concentration and calm and equanimity and compassion will bring one to liberation. And there are many, many ways to do that. And then he talked about that there's a mandala of skillful means. And then I said to him, of course, there are those who will say, that's well and good, but there really is a right way that we really do need to understand. That other paths might be good in certain ways, but they might actually not be leading to what the Buddha was talking about. And Jack said, that's the conservative position. But in fact, if you go back to the old countries of Thailand and Burma and Sri Lanka, you can't get the Theravada masters themselves to agree. See, I find this very liberating, not confusing. I've heard so many masters say, I teach the true way, right from the suttas, from the original. This is the real way the Buddha taught. I've heard a whole bunch of masters say that, and yet they contradicted one another when they said it. So I don't buy it. That's called ignorance. The real freedom is what Ajahn Chah understood. The real freedom is the freedom of letting go. It's not the freedom of clinging to what one believes is historically true, because what is historically true is this mandala, and it's not one way. So I appreciate that sensibility a lot, and I just want to offer that to you, and I hope we can all keep that. And then we can, as we start to talk about this and explore, not just tonight, but on your own, we can listen to what others say and how they teach and everything, and we don't have to make anyone right or wrong. We don't have to criticize others. We can just see that it's really a big world out there, and hopefully help us relax. And another thing I just want to offer, it's a little off topic, but maybe not, is that My view of this whole practice, the whole course of the Dharma, is it's a path that's leading us more and more to connect with and know and live from our own inner knowing and our own inner teacher. And we do that by, of course, we want to listen to teachers, and you know, we're not being disrespectful of anyone thinking, oh, I know. That's more of an ego thing. I'm not talking about that. But isn't it true that over time, with anything, with experience, and we have to do some experimentation and experience, we come to know what we can rely on and what's true and right and good and what might be we mistake for listening to our inner teacher when really we're just following our likes and dislikes. So over time, this coming to really rest in our own knowing grows and grows, and we'll know our own right way. And along the way, then we have to be open with the experimental attitude and be open to different teachings and hear and listen and try them on and all of that. So that is kind of how I want to frame this as we start. I spent a little time like this trying to frame this in a real inclusive, open, gentle way, because I want to tell you, in case you don't know, the topic of samadhi, discussing it, is fraught with danger. It's amazing how opinionated. There are Dharma wars out there over this stuff. For real. So I just want to say that I'm giving you my best understanding, my best take. Everything I'm going to say, both on samadhi and on insight, and I'm going to repeat this a couple of times to remind you, is necessarily way too brief, incomplete, and is, you know, there's many degrees of subtlety and other angles on it and a lot. So I'm just trying to hit some main themes to give us a main thing. But there's, you know, 99% that, you know, we could be here for the whole month and it maybe just kind of dip our toe in a little. So it's a big, big world out there. Okay. Part of this can be also because of the way that teachers, right? You'll hear teachers sometimes come from their own teaching, from what they know and what they feel is the most wise and skillful. Some teachers put more emphasis on samadhi. Some put less. And there are plenty of teachers out there who actually... This is maybe a little hard way to say it. I'm just not being that articulate, but are kind of, I don't know if you'd say anti-samadhi, but sort of really discouraged, saying, be careful because these are these meditative states. As we'll see, they can be very pleasant, and people tend to chase after them and get attached to them and think and all of that. And I do think that that is something we want to have some awareness about. So I do think there are teachers who tend to be very cautious, let's put it that way, around it. However, the Buddha was not one of them. The Buddha actually said, go for it. For real. I don't think they had that exact phrase back then. Let me just read you a couple of quotes here. This is in the Theravada tradition from the Pali Canon. These words are, the tradition puts these words in the mouth of the Buddha. I considered could jhana, I'm going to say the word jhana, this isn't a jhana talk tonight, but there are deep states of samadhi, let's just put it that way, that are called jhana, and that's a whole big topic too, so I might just touch on that a little, but just to know that some of these deeper states are defined in specific ways. And I considered, could jhana be the path to enlightenment? Then came the realization, that is the path to enlightenment. All right? Any confusion about that? Yeah. Okay, a couple more. Once again, the Buddha speaking, this is in the Samyutta Nikaya, one of the collections of in the Pali Canon. This is the Buddha. This isn't me. There are five detrimental things that lead to the decay and disappearance of the true Dhamma. That's the Pali Dharma in Sanskrit, of the true Dharma. We should pay attention to this. These five things lead to the decay and disappearance of the Dharma. What are the five? People, he talks about monks and nuns and lay people. They dwell without reverence and deference toward the teacher. That's one. They dwell without reverence and deference toward the Dharma, without towards the Sangha, toward the training. You know what the number five is? That leads to the detrimental thing that leads to the decay and disappearance of the true Dhamma. You dwell without reverence and deference towards concentration. So, just saying. One last one. And then I'll stop that. Jhana, remember those specialized samadhi states? This is the Buddha speaking again. Jhana is called the pleasure of renunciation, the pleasure of seclusion, the pleasure of peace, the pleasure of enlightenment. I say of this kind of pleasure that it should be pursued, that it should be developed, that it should be cultivated, that it should not be feared. Okay, so. Now, I've got to pause here for a moment. Here's the problem with all of that. Please don't fall into thinking, great, I gotta get. If the phrase, I gotta get, arises in your mind about anything, just pause there and hold on for a second. That's a setup for suffering. We know for a fact that you don't gotta get nothing. You don't. Because there are, as Jack was saying, there are great masters out there. And so you can, I don't know if you, but I've been around a few, not that many. There was a palpable experience in their present. I mentioned Goenka and Powak Sayadaw a few days ago, and I've met a few others who have come to this great depth of, what do you say, awakening, enlightenment, without a focus on samadhi. So there's no gotta get. You have to, and I don't want to spend more time just because of time tonight, but again, I want to emphasize that, but we just want to find our right relationship with samadhi. But the right amounts of samadhi, and I've had discussions with a lot of teachers about this, and I think everyone agrees, it's exactly what you have, as long as it's also informed with right view and right intention and all the other aspects of the Eightfold Path, it's right samadhi. There's no gotta get, but I'm reading these because of we want to also, we don't want to make samadhi any more than it is, and don't make a big deal about it, but we don't want to undervalue it either, is really the point I'm trying to make. All right. So, the word samadhi, typically translated as concentration. Now, they didn't ask my opinion when we're kind of stuck with the word concentration. I don't like it because it's got so many connotations in English that we bring onto it. If you get back to the etymology of the word, samadhi means undistracted, right? And while there may be a lot of disagreement among teachers and controversy and what concentration, there's how much you need, do you need, whatever, there's no disagreement about the value of being undistracted. Can you have too much undistractedness? If you put the right translation in, controversies just evaporate. No Buddhist teachers say, be distracted, right? So we see the value and think for yourself. You know, we all come on to retreat for whatever your daily life consciousness is for you. And you can have a lot of settledness of mind and maybe samadhi in daily life. It varies for all of us. But for many of us, we come into a certain level of kind of scattered mind, daily life, and we go through this settling in process in retreats. And every single person here, and some of you may not know this, but literally every single person here has really done a lot in the time you've been here. And think for yourself, not judging by what you think you're supposed to be, but as you settle in, the level of ability just to know what's happening in the moment and to work with, be present with things and everything, it's a whole different level when the undistractedness is, it's an ally and a support to help you meet your experience and be present and learn to let go. Yeah, I think many people find that. So you get to see for yourself the value there. So now the question is, in a formal sense, what are the different ways to to cultivate it. All right. If you were to stay with your breath and just stay with it, or as we always keep saying, other practices, not just breath, but I'm just going to say breath, and you just kept, as many of you are doing, just keep bringing your attention back to your breath, back to your breath, and you're cultivating your ability to just stay with your breath, right? Naturally, your ability, your skill at staying connected with your breath would strengthen and grow. And you would find, I think many of you are finding here, that the amount of time that you are lost and forget about bringing the breath just gets less, and you're able to have more of a continuity. And maybe some of you find that you tend to wander off and get lost less of the time compared to maybe, and maybe less deeply lost. It's not like we never are going to space out or be lost, right? And that can grow. If you were to continue that, as with anything, that skill or ability would continue to strengthen. And if you stayed with it, it could strengthen to the point where you were very skilled, or your ability to stay with the one object was very strong. And if you took that even further, you could get to a point where you were so good or so skilled at that muscle of your attention had been cultivated so strongly that your ability to stay connected just on that one thing, we say one point, but it's not really a point, but we use the word one-pointed. And you would so strongly, you would be kind of engrossed in that, we kind of sometimes say absorbed, and you would stop, you could get to the point where you don't even notice other experiences very much. The image I sometimes use is, you know, imagine you're sitting and reading and you're engrossed in a book, and someone walks up to me and they say, hey Richard, and I'm just reading, they go, hey Richard, and I go, oh, I'm sorry, what? Sorry, I didn't hear you, I was engrossed in the book. You get the idea? Because it's just your attention is engrossed. Even though there was a sound coming, you could take it so far that you wouldn't even notice your body anymore. And you could actually become disconnected. I don't mean that, not a negative connotation, in a way, from having an awareness of your body. Thoughts wouldn't be there, moods. The whole thing's gone, and it would only be, if you really took it far, the one thing of, then I'm going to say a little more about what can happen, but maybe it's, even breath would be gone. Maybe there's just, however you experience samadhi, there's a light, or it's blissful, or whatever. It's just on the samadhi itself. I'll explain the different ways it can manifest in just a few moments. That's how it could go to that point. If you did that, the changing flow of experiences would stop for you. Right? Wouldn't feel... Now, this is where I'm getting... it's going to be a little controversial, and some people may disagree with this. I'm stepping away from the text. This is just me speaking, so take it. You know. Even in there, there's a little movement of the mind that can happen. It's not everything totally stopped. You can, but it's subtle. Everything's getting subtler. But... for our conversation, we'll say the changing flow of experience will have stopped for you if you take it far enough. That's how far the undistractedness would go. You could be undistracted just on the one thing, right? We call that one-pointedness. Sometimes it's called exclusive concentration because the awareness is exclusively on the one thing, or it excludes everything else is another way to think about it. And it's a kind of stopping, right? Stopping the flow of experience. Does that make sense? You may not have experienced it, but get the idea, right? It's also, again, there's no negative connotation here, but it's kind of disconnecting in the sense. It connects to something deep, but it's disconnecting with parts of your experience, like your body or thoughts. Okay. There's another way that the samadhi can unfold on its own naturally. People tend to go in these two directions naturally. And you could take it far enough, there's still a stopping, but it's a different kind of stopping. Now I'm going to use the term the mind here. And I'm not going for a laugh when I say, I don't know what the mind is. I don't. We use the term, in so many different ways. But I'm just using it, you'll just get the idea, where it's just as deep and strong as the first samadhi I just told you, the exclusive one-pointedness. Only rather than the flow of changing flow of experiences stopping, the mind comes to a stop. It's kind of, you could say unmoving, if these words are a little clumsy, but just this kind of crude way to speak. But the changing flow of experience still happens. It's a different kind of stopping. It's not the stopping of experience, it's the stopping of the flow of experience. And I'll read you something to give you the idea on that one. This is a quote, some of you have heard this many, many times, but from Ajahn Chah, but I think it captures it very nicely. Famous quote. "Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become still in any surroundings, like a clear forest pool." So see that kind of open, your mind becomes still like a clear forest pool. "All kinds of wonderful, rare animals will come to drink at the pool." In other words, all these experiences will come and go. "And you will clearly see the nature of all things. You will see many strange and wonderful things come and go, but you will be still. This is the happiness of the Buddha." So that's kind of my take, again, just for me personally, about this other kind of stopping, where the mind stops. And one way I think about this, I'm going to say something about the brain, but I want to be clear, I really know almost nothing about brain science, so I'm just going to, this may not act, for those of you who know about brain science, what I'm saying may actually not be accurate, but I think it'll make the point. Okay. If there's certain brain centers or areas in the brain functioning, that when those come to quiescence, the mind comes to a complete stillness of undistracted presence, unmoving. Those are the same in both of these kind of samadhis. But in the first one that was inclusive, we also bring other brain centers to quiescence so that you that allow you to experience the body and thoughts and all that. Whereas in the second kind, those other kinds are left alone. They can still function, even though the part that made it come to the stillness is the same in both. Now, I'm just speaking experientially here. This is how it feels from the inside when these things happen. Okay, so once again, I'm getting away from the text and just kind of more experiential. I want to point that out when I do that. Yeah, but do you get the idea? This second kind, rather than calling it exclusive, I call it inclusive. Again, there's no value judgment on these. These are all important. They've been very powerful for many people and all these. There's no good or bad here, but we're just sort of naming some differences. I call the second inclusive because we don't stop the other flow of experience. We're actually more connected than ever with the body, the mind, because we're so present. And to distinguish the term ekagata in Pali between the two, rather than using the term one-pointedness, for this kind I call it unification of mind. And another way I use it, and again, I want to be careful, this is just me and other people, this is controversial. I'm not going to point out all the controversies, but I'm giving the talk, so I'm kind of giving you my take, okay? the first kind I call disconnecting. That's just how it experiences to me. The second kind I call it connecting. Because in my experience, I've actually been more profoundly connected in the body. So it's just two different styles, okay? Yeah, basically good enough. I'm kind of spending a little time here. Just even though you may not have experience, you get the idea. Okay. These two ways, it's actually not just two, but I'm speaking just broadly kind of to make a point. There's blends and there's just like a big, big world there. But we're just going to leave it at that for simplicity's sake. I think will help us. You can go in one of these two directions naturally on your own. You will. If nobody was there working with you and no one taught you, you could go different directions. And I work with people, and sometimes I want to know which way they want to go, and that's fine. And then you can support them in either way is fine. In addition to the natural unfolding, you can steer it back in the other direction, both ways. And I don't want to get into the how about that, but it's actually not hard to do. I maybe could say a little bit if we have some time, but I could speak to you one-on-one about that, but just it can just be steered in either direction too. So we have already, we're getting some choice points, and so we want to know, well, why would I choose to steer one way or the other? And maybe that might come out a little bit as we continue. All right. In addition to just what I've been talking about is just the actual undistractedness of the mind itself, and a couple of just sort of kind of main ways we could think about it. Again, it's actually many variations, but that's kind of just to get these two points. There's many other experiences that can and typically do arise. So if any of you have had any degree of settling in or concentration, whatever you want to call it, you may notice that it can be pleasant. It can be real pleasant, right? Very pleasant. And that pleasure, you have to see how it is for you, manifests in a range of ways. Earlier in the retreat, they used this term piti, P-I-T-I, which gets translated as bliss, rapture. Sometimes there's piti and sukha. Sukha's kind of, I use sukha, pleasure in the body, or happiness if it's in the mind. But those two words have been used for piti also, if you look up all the translations out there for piti. But piti is generally considered to be more energetic. It can be energies moving in the body, or you don't know where it's moving. It could be more in the mind, or something. You just feel it, but you don't know where it is. Some people see lights. I think most people just don't, but it's just the, you know, everybody's different. But some do. It could be very, you know, kind of want to go into the light. And if you do, you won't be complaining. It's great. It is. It's understandable people chase after those states. I mean, they really are very, they feel good. And when you're in them, there's something, it just feels like you're on a level of clarity and seeing on levels of reality. And they're just conditioned states. But it's understandable that we would want more of that. Actually, I'll say this. This is just me. Other teachers may say something different. I think it's actually okay to want it. The trick is, how do you cultivate it without chasing after it, clinging to it, making an object, you know, of grasping and clinging, as opposed to saying something feels supportive here and feels good and right. It can be healing, it can be resourcing, it can be nurturing. There's a lot of benefits there, right? So it's okay, right? And the reason I don't worry about people suffering about clinging too much to it is because if you do, as it's happened, just probably most people are going to do this at some point, you're going to suffer. You're going to learn, okay? And we learn, and we move on. So I don't think we have to worry that much, personally. But that's kind of for me. A lot of teachers have suffered a lot, and I think that's kind of maybe why they want to be, you know, cautious with people about that. So, all right. Some people hear sounds. I don't think most people do statistically, but I could be a little off there. But also I want to say this. I'm a little rusty on the Pali Suttas, because I just don't study them so much in recent years. But when I wrote my book on Samadhi here, I went through the suttas in complete detail and found every reference to Samadhi and Piti and Sukha and all these kind of things. And to what I could find, it's possible what I'm about to say is incorrect. I've missed it. Though in the suttas actually doesn't define what Piti is. In a later text I'm going to mention in a few moments, it goes into great detail about what it is, but in the suttas. So depending on which of these systems you're within Theravada you're practicing in, we may have a real idea of what piti is and sukha, or not. But from my experience, it's highly individual. For some people, all this other stuff, the pleasant, is very smoothed out, and for some people it can be quite strong and dramatic, and actually can be too much. Okay, so we have these two things. Undistracted mind, which can manifest in kind of what I'm calling inclusive or exclusive, just as a way of speaking. And then there's all the other experiences of samadhi. And for shorthand, right now I'm just going to call it the samadhi. That's not right, but it's just a way of speaking. Okay. One of the problems that can happen sometimes is as we get concentrated, we get into the pleasant, we get into the experience, our attention is engrossed in that. And we miss sight of the clear presence, the undistracted mind that's there. So that's an interesting place to check into when, all this, whatever else might be going on for you, which may be just a light touch or might be quite strong. It's just individual, however it is. There is that, and there's always alongside of it, whatever that looks like, just the clear presence. And if you remember from time to time, don't make a project out of it, but just check in. You can know the clear mind is there. And that's really what's of value in the service of insight. Okay. Now I want to take, this will be super fast, I think I can do it in less than 5 minutes, just a little touch of history, which I think will help us. Okay. So according to tradition, within a few months of when the Buddha died, there was a gathering of the most senior monastics who had been around the Buddha. It's called the First Great Council. And the tradition tells us that during that time, because during the Buddha, they didn't write this stuff down. So they wanted to come to some agreement about, make sure we're all in agreement about what the teachings were. And Ananda was the Buddha's younger cousin. And Ananda had been the Buddha's personal attendant for the last 25 years of the Buddha's life. So he was hanging around all the time there, and he heard all the Dharma talks, right? So they questioned Ananda on things, and I can imagine them. It brings it very alive to me. You know, it was just like this, right? There was a Buddha sitting there, just like we are now, and people sitting around. This is how alive it was. And so I imagine him saying, hey, Ananda, remember that time when the Blessed One was at such and such, and did he give a talk? They're kind of questioning him like that, right? It's recorded in formalized language. But for me, it comes very alive. And when you read the Pali texts, a lot of them start with, thus have I heard. That's Ananda recounting the story. So he's talking to you right there. That's how alive it is. Thus have I heard. Oh, Ananda's speaking to me. And he tells. And they came to some understanding of what the teachings was. And according to tradition, those texts, they evolved. It was still an oral tradition for a few centuries, but really became what are called, in the Pali language, the sutta, in Sanskrit sutras, but in Pali sutta, and became like the discourses and the teachings. And then there was another monk who was known to be the expert on the monastic code, and he was questioned and he laid out, and that became the code of conduct for monastics, and that became the Vinaya. Sometimes you'll hear it pronounced Vinaya, monastic code. That's part of this group that's called the Pali Canon. There's a third piece called the Abhidhamma that I'm just not addressing this evening at all. It's not positive or negative, but that's not part of this tonight. Okay. These were written down, and naturally, it could really be hard to imagine otherwise, they're going to evolve and change until they were finally written down. I don't know, I'm making this number up. 400 years after the Buddha. I'm not sure how the dates, people used to say the Buddha was 563 to 483 BCE, but I don't keep up with it in the last few decades, so I think it may have changed. Maybe they moved the Buddha up a century or something. We don't really know. So a few centuries before it was finally written down. But until then, it could change, right? Things can change. All right. Along that time, people naturally wanted to understand and discuss and kind of tease out their best understanding of what the teachings were. So it's quite understandable that a body of commentarial literature arose also. And the culmination of that was, and this is a book I want to say something about tonight, was, we don't know the exact dates, but I'm going to say 600-800 years after the Buddha or something. I may be a little off. Some people may know the dates. Buddhaghosa wrote a treatise. It's not a commentary. It's a treatise that brings the commentarial understanding together in one book. And it's a long tongue twister name called Vasuddhimagga. It means path of purification. That book is a big deal in Theravada Buddhism. It's important. By the way, I say with a V, sometimes you'll hear the V's around here pronounced with a W sound. So that's, we don't really know how they were pronouncing. There's not a right or wrong. The W is more of a, I'd say probably a Burmese pronunciation. Other places is the V. I just use V as a V. So you'll hear it both ways, but Vasudhimagga. Okay. Now, that's what I want to say a little about history. For Theravada Buddhists, for some, to understand the teachings of the suttas, the whole understanding funnels through the lens of the Vasudhimagga. If you want to understand it, there's teachers that you got to understand the Vasudhimagga. And then there's a whole other big piece in Theravada that goes, no, Buddhaghosa got it wrong. And they ignore that. And that's part of the reason I just want to say a little bit about this. Again, to me, I have great respect for all of this. But I want to kind of understand the differences. And this is really getting into controversial territory, what I'm going to say. Just be aware of that. No matter what I say, some Theravada Buddhist out there is going to disagree. Doesn't matter what I say. So now we're free. Can say anything we want because they're going to be mad at us no matter what. Okay. Let's talk about the Vasudhimagga for a moment. This is the last piece, and then we're going to talk more practical. Vasudhimagga clearly divides the path of meditation into two paths, samatha and vipassana. Samatha means calm, tranquility, serenity. Vipassana is the insight. Two paths. Most of the Vasudhimagga is focused on the path of samatha. If you read it, I have read the whole thing. And it was rough too, because that's a. I'm not being disrespectful from the Vasudhimagga. Actually, it's so important in the tradition. I actually have tremendous respect. I don't personally practice in that style, but I have tremendous respect for it. I mean, it's rough because it's not a light read, is what I mean. Right? You know, you have to kind of dedicate yourself to get through it and read it. That's all I meant. Let me say something about the path of samatha. In the path of samatha, you are aiming for to develop these deep states called jhana. Because of the power that they see in having a really clear, concentrated mind, and then after that, you turn your attention to insight practices. And they're very specific in there. Remember I was telling you these two kinds of samadhi, sort of inclusive and exclusive, it's the first kind where you lose connection with changing experience, right? And I'm not going to get into more detail about it because we could spend the whole evening just on that. But they're really clear. There's many practices, and there's like 40 meditation practices that are laid out and talk about the way the experiences arise. But you're aiming to. You may hear the term access concentration sometimes. That's defined in a specific way with the rising of this counterpart sign, which can be a light or it can be in the body. There's different ways it's described. And then you put your attention on that and you kind of go into the light, I guess, or go into the bliss is kind of how maybe I've experienced it. And then you... If your understanding of insight, which I'm going to talk about in a few moments, is that you have to stay connected with changing experience, you can see why, in that understanding, concentration would be something different than insight, because you've disconnected from changing experience, right? So in that system of practice, insight is something different. And then you have to kind of back out of the jhana so you can feel changing experience again, but you still have this clear, powerful, undistracted mind, but now you're connected back with change, and now you can consciously turn your attention to doing insight practices, which are specifically four elements practice, three characteristics. Well, I'm going to actually talk about that next week. Looking into impermanence and dukkha and suffering and selflessness and all that, and all this range of practice to look at that. That's the path of samatha. And you get the idea. It's not a right or wrong. If they're telling you to develop that kind of jhana, and if you think insight depends on changing experiences, then insight and concentration are two different. They're connected, but they're not the same practices, right? It's not right. So now we can see maybe that's how some people are practicing in that system. All right. There's a lot more about that, but because of time, I'm just kind of moving a little quickly here. We're still in the Visuddhimagga here. In the Visuddhimagga, the path of Vipassana is one in which you do not aim for and you do not attain jhana, and you want to gain a certain amount of concentration. It's called momentary concentration. And actually, it's in a little tucked away passage in the Visuddhimagga, one little place. It actually defines it as being equal in strength to access concentration that I just mentioned for jhana. So it's not meant to be, you know, you're pretty concentrated. But it's technically not access concentration because you don't get a counterpart sign. So anyway, forget that if that went over. I know I'm moving fast here for time. Anyway, that some of you will stick, some of you won't. You want to get momentary concentration, enough samadhi to really connect, but you go directly to the insight practices. And the idea there is that you have all the concentration you need just by doing the insight practices, right? Okay, now here's the real most controversial thing I'm going to say for the evening. But it's no judgment. That path of pure insight is our entire scene here. It's been influenced by many other things. I wish the other teachers were here. I wanted them to actually hear me make that statement. But fortunately, Temple is here. So, and we were joking. I said, well, you know, you can correct my errors later. This is me speaking. Other people may have a different take on it. And many other influences, of course, come in. It's been heavily influenced by one great Burmese master, Mahasi, and through Pandita and others. And he was a Visuddhimagga guy. His understanding of jhana was this way. And, you know, he was taking people. Actually, he did a great service because he opened up accessibility to so many people who go right to the insight practices. And, you know, not to be some monastic off in a cave for however many years trying to get this jhana, and it was accessible to everyone. So we did a tremendous benefit. People have gotten tremendous benefit. Many of you are practicing in this way. You're just putting your mind on changing experience. You're right there, momentary concentration. You're doing this path, right? And you see the power for yourself, okay? So again, that was quick. It was, I think it was mostly because of the incompleteness of it. There's some things that aren't exactly right, but it's good enough for the points I'm trying to make. All right, now let's go back to the Pali Suttas. What I'm about to say now is also highly controversial, and I'm not really trying to be controversial about it. You see how I am. It's like I just have respect for everything, but I'm going to make a statement here. When I wrote my book on samadhi, I chickened out on a few things. I softened my language. Let me say it this way. I'm just going to say it. Visuddhimagga and the sutta paths have a lot in common, but they have some fundamental differences. I am saying, this is just me, that the jhana in the suttas is that inclusive kind. I can prove it. Okay, that was a laugh line. But I didn't get any laughs. Okay, never mind. But that's my take on it. Other people will say, no, that's not true. And you can find evidence in the suttas to support whatever you want. But the way I look at the suttas, there is no clear separation between concentration and insight. They're different things. You can find places in there, like you take the four foundations of mindfulness, it doesn't talk about jhana, Satipatthana Sutta. So you can just say, well, there it is, and they're not focusing. But in the context of the whole suttas, it makes such a tremendous deal about jhana. My take on it is fine, we'll get someone else in here, they'll just tell the opposite, fine. My take on it is that the jhana of the suttas is not disconnecting, it's profoundly connecting. And you don't have to come out of any state of samadhi to do something else called insight. You can. It's all good. But it's not quite a hard distinction. And so I tend to be known as someone who kind of, that's my way. It's kind of one path kind of a thing. Just a different take. Right? But it's true that the suttas, it's just not clear like the Vasuddhimagga. The Vasuddhimagga is very clear. And there's a lot of places in the suttas, and we should say, that are, it's not clear. And it doesn't lay it all out real explicitly in one place. So it's naturally, understandably open to a range of interpretations. So that's how we can hold it with that spacious mind, like Jack was talking about, right? All right. One last thing, and then I think I can do this in time. We put a lot of emphasis in our tradition here about the liberation comes through insight. And the traditional way is insight to what we call the three characteristics. It's like into impermanence, into dukkha, which we say suffering but is unreliable nature of things, which turns into suffering if we cling. And we talk about this no self, which I'm going to get into in a week, next week. What do we really mean by it? And when we can perceive that or understand that very, very profoundly and deeply, a deep letting go of clinging can happen. And that's how it happens for many, many people. There are people, but it's not what, this is just me also now speaking. I say that actually the liberation through non-clinging arises in different ways for different people. It's not one way. And just to make one distinction, for some people, there's probably insights going on, but some people, they just kind of, through settling the mind and doing the practices, they just kind of open up into this kind of an equanimity and a presence. And they may not have been consciously aware that it happened without having any insights. Experientially in their consciousness, it just went right into equanimity. For others, you really get the kind of the power of the insights that are happening and how it's freeing your mind. So it's not one way. Experientially. What's really going on deep down, I don't know that, right? All right. So, the path then of insight, let's come back. We're not in the Vasuddhimagga, we're just here on this retreat, right? You could practice in a way, we would call it a kind of, I'm just separating them out a little for the sake of discussion. You could practice in a way that we'll call it emphasizing the insight side of the practice, and that's your practice. And by doing that, the idea, right, is that just like we said, you want to be present with changing experience, you want to connect with your mind, with your body, with everything, learn to let go of our suffering, learn to be present without clinging, all the stuff we're talking about here. And by doing that, you get all the concentration you need, which is true. It's absolutely true, and we see that, and that's really my take on the main way we're teaching here, right? Some of us may, within that, want to give a little more emphasis than others to specifically the concentration side. We may stay with the breath more, or whatever it is. It's not just the breath. Even that momentary concentration on changing experiences. I know people get into jhana with that, so it's highly individual, but we may want to consciously bring in the concentration, but our emphasis is like aiming towards connecting with change and suffering and all of that. We'll call that maybe the path of insight, just as a way of speaking. Once again, they're not really separate. Some people may feel like they're on the path of concentration, and the idea there, in whatever kind of concentration you're built, inclusive, exclusive, you are saying, you know, I think there's a value in taking time and just really leaning on the concentration side. But even there, you know, if you say, and then there's, you know, people who are sort of a third way, I guess it's holding them both equally in your mind. But it doesn't really matter, because if you say you're going to be on the insight emphasis in your practice, you have to bring mindfulness. You have to bring the heart qualities in there. So you're not beating yourself up too much when we're judging ourselves. All the heart qualities come in. You have to bring to bear all the powers of concentration, right? To work with your mindfulness and to be present. You can't really separate it out. And if you think you want to emphasize the concentration side, you got to bring in the mindfulness. You got to bring in the heart qualities. Even if it just informs some kindness to your breath, there's still some love and compassion that comes in. And all the insight parts have to come in, and how we work with the difficulties and challenges and everything. You have to have that wisdom to come in too. You really can't separate them out. in practice. Theoretically, in texts we can, but in practice, they really have to all come together in some way or other. Okay. All right. One last thing then. Let's take an example. There are many examples I could use, but I'm going to pick one. Let's take the four foundations of mindfulness, and maybe, I don't remember if we've used the term satipatthana in here. Sati, mindfulness, and patthana, we're not sure what, we'll say supports or foundations or, right? And there's these four, right? This is what we're talking about. I'm just going to say this real quick, first foundation is mindfulness of the body, and it's divided into a lot of different mindfulness of breathing, four postures, all daily activities, and then there's Temple had spoken about the four elements is in there and some other practices too, so it's mindfulness of the body, that's the first foundation. Second is the Vedana, right? We call it the feeling tone, pleasant, unpleasant, or neither. We want to be able to bring mindfulness. Third is what we call, I guess, mind states, right? I don't know if we've really talked about that much, but we will be. Not thoughts, but like, is greed, hatred, or delusion in your mind? You know it. And if it's not in your mind, you know that. And there's other things. Is your mind concentrated? You know it. It doesn't tell you to get concentrated. It just says no. Or if you're not concentrated, and there's other things, it's mind states. And then the fourth foundation, which I believe we'll talk about more too, which is really quite interesting. It's a list of five. It's got five. If you don't know what these lists are, don't worry, but just let it go. But five aggregates, six sense bases, five hindrances, seven factors of enlightenment, four noble truths. And for all of those, it talks a lot about working with them, how to work with them. Not just being mindful, but seeing the ways we suffer around them or let go of our suffering around them. It's a lot, and I'm just mentioning. The four foundations of mindfulness, you may have noticed, is taught and practiced in quite a range of ways. And I think it's quite wonderful, so we can find the way that's accessible for each of us. So this is trying to bring in about how maybe the concentration piece can come in different ways of approaching it. One of the ways that the way we teach here is over time we open the instructions up. We tend to start with some kind of, we call it an anchor or foundational practice, like the breath or sound or touch points or all these other things you might do. Stay with that, get some stability, some undistractedness for a few days. And then at some point we start to open up the instructions and we include others of the body, more of the body. The four postures, all activities as we move about. We might introduce the four elements, which I really think is a particularly, for me, has been a particularly powerful aid to view experience in that way. And then over time, our minds get more subtle and we can start to notice the pleasant and unpleasant. We get more subtle and we can start to notice the third foundation, mind states, and we just expand out the instructions. Even within that, some people will always choose to still give some degree of emphasis just to the breath still, even though we're just quite ready to let go and open up to anything that'll happen because we have all these tools in our toolkits, the whole four foundations. And for others, I know some of you are practicing in this way, at some point we don't give any particular emphasis to the anchor, the breath, at all. It's part of just the changing flow that's presenting itself to us moment by moment, and just where whatever's predominant moment by moment, our mindfulness is there. For some of us, we're practicing a way to bring our attention moment to moment to, we call it objects. Others are kind of resting back in open, spacious awareness and just receiving all this experience. So there's a range of ways that we can work with four foundations, and we each find our way. Also, some teachers emphasize one of the foundations over the others. And Jack had said, for example, there are some teachers who will emphasize mindfulness of the body is the best way, or some say mindfulness of the mind. Those are examples of teachers who are emphasizing, they're open to it all, but they really are giving an emphasis on one particular foundation. So you may hear sometimes that people will teach in that way. You may be drawn to teach in that way too. Okay, that's a way you can approach it. All of the ways that I just mentioned are prescriptive. They're prescribing how to practice. Temple, in his talk on anapanasati, anapana, in-breathing and out-breathing, mindfulness of breathing, talked about these steps and everything. And one of the things he mentioned is that's very, very important. I feel just as important as the Four Foundations of Mindfulness Sutta in Theravada Buddhism. And it says in there, there's another way you can practice too. And it says, just through mindfulness of breathing alone, it completely fulfills all the four foundations. And by doing that, it fulfills this other important list, which is called the Seven Factors of Enlightenment, which in my mind is one of the most important lists of all. And I think someone may give a talk on that, but that's just my own personal favorite list. So here's one way you could think of it. It's just another way in the mix of ways. And this tends to be, I'm sharing this as we end, it happens to be my own style. But again, it's not better than any other style, but it's just been, I'm sharing with you mine. It's more descriptive. Sometimes I do the prescriptive. I would actually consciously turn my attention to working in all these different ways. But for me, fundamentally, as the samadhi deepened through the mindfulness of breathing, that's been my entire practice. Well, you know, look, at some point it gets beyond all these techniques, right? And it cuts under itself, but that's a different conversation. But yeah, that's been my whole, let's just say that's been my practice, mindfulness of breathing. I've just stuck with the one thing. It's opened in that inclusive kind of samadhi. I've done some things in the other way too, but that's really been my main way. And I have found by doing that, everything else in the Satipatthana was just there. Let me ask you a question. When you're here on retreat and you're walking around during the day, and you know at this stage in the retreat, because you're deeper and more settled, you're going to space out a lot. You're not going to notice everything. But isn't it true that if something's going on in your mind, you know it? Come on, don't you? I mean, a lot of the time, it's right there. The power of your undistracted mind is carrying with you. If something's going on in your body, you know it. Sometimes we get caught and we don't know it, yes. That knowing of what's happening more and by more just grows. And then it's more descriptive, describing what happens when you just take mindfulness of breathing and let the inclusive samadhi go. Then it just naturally opens up. If there's greed, hatred, and delusion in my mind, I know it. I mean, except for the times when I don't know it. But I don't worry about that. What are you going to do? And actually, for me, my practice these days has gotten very, very simple. I still meditate. I know for many people it's hard to have a practice in daily life. I think most people find it challenging. I've tended to have a pretty strong daily practice. I still do to this day, practice a fair amount each day. I don't know what would happen if I stopped. I haven't done the experiment, so I don't know. But what I find is that wakeful, that stream of non-clinging is like carries. I'm not making any big claims. I can get reactive and caught, but a lot is just carrying through. It's kind of a fruit of the sitting practice. And then I use my day not looking to try and be mindful. I just more pay attention to what's going on in my heart and mind. If my heart's closed off, I know it. Let go, open the heart. If I'm caught in clinging, if my heart's open and I'm in the stream of non-clinging, I just live. I don't do anything. Not lost in it with awareness. And when my heart's closed, open the heart. Caught in clinging, let go. It's a real simple practice. Other times, we may want to then do more paying attention mindfully to objects and things. If that serves us too, it's a lot of different ways, right? A lot of ways that the four foundations of mindfulness can unfold and reveal itself to us. It's not just one way, right? So what I want to invite you to do, I don't know if this was, I hope It kind of just laid out like that there's a range of ways. It was kind of ambitious to try to do this in one talk. I realized that, so I was able to just kind of touch. Kind of get a sense of why are these different ways? Oh, there was these different texts that developed, and it kind of filtered down through us through that. Different understandings, different emphasis. And we can hold them all with an inclusive mind. And then what I hope for each of us is we don't get confused or, you know, again, think there's a right or best way, but we can then go back to what I said at the beginning, which is over time, more and more, we learn to attune to our inner knowing. Not our inner ego, but our inner teacher. And then I really feel that for many of us, sometimes it's not clear and we're confused and then we get help, but over time, more and more, we're able to kind of find our own relationship with these, find the right practices, find the right place to land. And then it doesn't matter about everything else because we've really found our way, our doorway in. I like to think of these things like, this isn't exactly how I guess it works, but I kind of think like there's that inner sanctuary and all these different doorways in. Let's not get hung up on a particular doorway. They're just doorways. The one that works best is the way in, and they all, I really feel, kind of meet in this place, which is the heart of love, the mind of non-clinging. Right. So, you know, we're really all like meeting in there together, which is really a beautiful thing, I think. Okay. Well, I hope this was helpful. If so, great. And, you know, if it was too much or whatever, just let go. I'll end with, no, but seriously, like there's the, you know, the clothes shopping analogy? I'm not much of a clothes shopper, but you know, you go to the store and whatever, I don't know, shirts. There's a bunch of shirts on there. And you just go there and you look and you look, and maybe one of it looks interesting. Take it off, try it on. If it's a fit and you like it, and if the price is right, you keep it. If not, what do you do? You just stick it back on the rack and you keep moving on. Right? And we want to be a little careful with Dharma teachings because we can get caught into our likes and dislikes. So but we do the best we can. But we feel what really resonates for us. And then the experimental attitude is we can go with that. Yeah. And try it out. So thank you for your kind attention. I very much appreciate it. And let's just sit quietly, literally for about, I went over about 6 minutes, so we'll just take maybe 3 or 4 breaths together and I'll ring the bell.